This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Yeah, g'day, Warwick Long with you for one more week. Nikolai Bailhartz will return next week on the Country Hour. Today, water is hitting high prices again, and it might look like panic buying in the market, but is it a new normal? We'll speak to water market watchers to find out more. Stone fruit exports are booming too, and China is to thank for that at the moment. And today on the Country Hour, we're talking turkey. Yes, with some special birds from Dadswell Bridge that are, well, should I just say, gorgeous.
And these are what I call the fated ones. They look like somebody threw a can of paint at their wings when you spread their wing feathers out. And they all have blue eyes.
But they're also very useful. Without them, you could lose your gobble, you could be stuffed, or even worse, dare I say, you'd be plucked. What am I talking about? You'll have to keep listening. Come to the Country Hour for the rural news and information. Stay for the dad jokes.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Let's get a little bit more serious for the moment, though. The Victorian Premier is being accused of snubbing drought-stricken farmers in the state's northwest. Grain growers near Milawa are facing drought conditions again this year, and the rainfall figures will shock you. Here's James O'Day speaking to us on the Country Hour on Friday.
Yeah, no, we've had 51 mil for the year, and our biggest one rain has been 8 mil.
That sounds really unusual, is it?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, we're used to sort of being on the drier end of the stick up here, but no, that's bloody dry even for us.
How long have you been farming there, James?
Me and myself, about 30 years.
How does it compare to your other years farming?
Yeah, certainly the dry stuff seen in my time, so.
As dry as he's seen in a generation, really, of farming, over 30 years. It's almost a lifetime of farming for some people. 51 millimetres for the year and 8 millimetres is the largest single rainfall event that he's had. It's prompted the Victorian Farmers Federation to call on the government to financially help those producers who are doing it tough. Sheree von Hirschner spoke with the VFF's Livestock Group President, Leonard Valance, who says the Premier, Daniel Andrews, snubbed drought-stricken farmers on a recent visit to the region's hospital.
And it's noticeable that the Premier's up there, and here we are, we've got severe drought conditions west of Mildura, and the Premier's not going out there to talk to the farmers. And those guys are in their third year of drought, and he just doesn't seem to care.
Have you been calling, or have you been having conversations with the Premier to discuss that area and getting it drought declared with your Victorian Farmers Federation hat on?
I've met with the Minister for Agriculture, and our President, David Johenke, been engaged with both the Premier's office and the Minister for Agriculture to get something done for the people in the far northwest of the state, and also in East Gippsland, where they're in there in a fairly dire strait down there as well. But there's not a great deal of response. The VFF want rate subsidies for the people affected, because in both, particularly west of Mildura, where they have water rates and shire rate bills to pay, that's going to be a huge burden on those people. You've got to remember that these people will not grow anything this year. The Milawa region is defined by the river on one side, on the north side, and the big desert on the south side of it. And so while it's not a terribly large area of land, you know, on a state basis, it is a significant contributor to the state's wealth. And there are 50-odd farms out there. They're farming families that invest their money in the state to produce food for people to eat, and they're really struggling.
Although Premier Daniel Andrews didn't make a funding announcement to drought-stricken farmers in the Milawa region while he was in Mildura, he did encourage producers to get in touch with the government for help.
Well, Agriculture Victoria and Minister Symes are more than happy to provide any support that we can. There's a package of different measures. I know it's deeply frustrating. I was talking with some growers from the northwest just recently who were telling me that they're heading towards their best season in 10 years, and others who are doing it very tough. It's patchy, and we know that that's a deeply frustrating thing for growers and their families, and indeed for small and large businesses who rely upon that income. So there are things we have been doing for other drought-affected areas of the state. There are things we can offer, things that we can do, and I'd encourage people to be sitting down with us through local government and through other agencies. But if there's a need for Minister Symes to come and with Ali and others to have a talk to some of those affected communities, then we're more than happy to do that.
That's Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews, who was speaking in Mildura last week but didn't head out to drought-stricken farmers. Should he? You can let us know. You can call 1300 977 222, 1300 977 222, or you can text 0467 842 722. That report from Cherie von Hirschner. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 10 past 12. Let's go to horticulture now. And 4 months after casuals in the horticulture sector won a pay increase, growers say they're moving towards automation and changing their systems to cut back on overtime. New pay rates were introduced in April for casuals who work more than 38 hours a week, 12 hours a day, or night shifts. David Claughton reports from large vegetable producers in Gippsland to see if the dire predictions about the impact of the new pay rates have come true.
Almost 60,000 people work in horticulture around the country, growing, harvesting and packing fruit, vegetables and nuts for domestic and export markets. There's plenty of workers in this baby spinach packing shed on Bulmer Farms at Lindenau, many of them foreign. There's a 50-50 chance that the spinach in your shopping trolley is from here. Andrew Bulmer is frustrated by the decision to increase casual pay rates.
The new laws, from our perspective, from a grower's perspective, are silly because they limit the ability for our people to earn extra money. Casuals used to be able to work as many hours as they could under the old award. Now, once they go over 38 hours, they're entitled to overtime, which means we'll either have to employ more people, or we'll cut back on production, or we'll look at ways to automate to take more people or more jobs away for the industry, right, which is not what you want.
Bulmer says the new nighttime rates are too much for growers who are operating on very tight margins.
Yeah, we do a lot of nighttime harvesting here. That's really good for the baby spinach, obviously. If you pick it in the heat of the day, it wilts, you lose quality. Nobody wants that product. So we tend to pick a lot of ours at night, but the 15% loading goes from 8:30 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. in the morning. Once you go over that 38 hours, over an average of 304 hours over 8 weeks, then you're up to time and a half, which is, I think it's around about $23.88. If you're paying time and a half and you're up at $36 an hour to pick baby spinach, you're not going to get that return.
Down the road at Motta Produce, the country's biggest producer of baby asparagus is looking at ways to cut back on overtime. Alex Motta says that's hard to do because asparagus has to be picked when it's ready, and that can mean long hours for workers.
The biggest expense for us in our industry is labour, because everything is still hand harvested. Every spear is cut one at a time by hand. And we know the new horticultural award, the changes that come in with penalty rates and night rates, are going to have a big impact on us, just simply because the man hours in the harvest season, yeah, are massive. And
how much will that increase your labour bill, do you reckon?
Oh, look, it's hard exactly for us to say whether we're going to have to change a few of our techniques and the way we go about it. But it's definitely going to impact, whether it's 20% or 30%, because every season's different, and the amount of days in a row that we have to be harvesting and packing can change season to season. Last season wasn't so intense, but, you know, this could be completely different. Like asparagus, in the peak of our season, they're growing, 15 to 20 centimetres a day. So sometimes it gets out of control and it might be a 12-hour day. But most of the time, it's probably an 8 or 9-hour day.
Bonview Orchards supply Woolworths from their sites in Gippsland. They've been preparing for automation for a few years now and expect to have robots picking their apples at the next harvest. Farm manager James Gaffney says the new casual pay rates have sped up change.
It'll increase the costs, definitely, and that's when the robots come in. The platforms, the pickers, everything like that.
Robots?
Yeah, pick a plucker machine that kind of, does everything as much as you can just to minimise labour.
Because you've flattened your trees too, haven't you? Like they're growing horizontally and they're growing almost like grapes.
Basically, yeah, we've got the 2D system here that everything's grown on a wire. Better for the pickers. Yeah. Everyone's happy, the fruit's better, more sunlight.
Yep. And how does it pick then?
We don't know too much about it at the moment. It's an American-based machine. It's just come into Australia and,
How much would that system cost?
Oh, look, a lot of these machines are $250,000 to $500,000, plus the computer program, so it's a lot of money.
Is the change to the Hawke Code and the increasing cost of labour the reason why the company's going robotic?
Well, it's kind of left us no option but to go robotic in a certain things. Trouble is, it's these robotic machines that you've got to go for these new 2D systems, so everything's nice and on the wire, otherwise it doesn't seem to work.
Yeah. So you've got to completely change your orchard.
Exactly.
While many growers are deeply unhappy with the new pay rates, the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union says some of the claims being made are a bit much. Workers deserve a living wage, and the extra money in pay packets will flow through to local communities.
David Claughton with that report. We'll stay in the world of horticulture now with the news. It's been a stunning year for summer fruit exports, with more than 20,000 tonnes of stone fruit being sent abroad. Sheree von Hirschner caught up with Summer Fruits Australia CEO Trevor Ranford.
It's been an exceptional season for the industry as far as exports are concerned, with over 23,000 tonne of peaches, plums, nectarines and apricots exported. That's the highest level, or higher than 2003, which was the last sort of peak period. And so volumes are up, values are up, and you know, return to grower have been very strong.
Did you expect that, considering it was such a hot summer?
I think the industry has been working towards it. This is the third year that the Chinese market's been open, and obviously the first couple of years the industry struggled with quality, what to send, how to send, and you know, the industry now is a lot more focused on ensuring quality product gets into the market, and the returns are there. So we've been planning on it.
You say there that there was a few teething moments in the lead up, teething moments in the last couple of years. What exactly in regards to exports to China?
Again, I think it's understanding the market. People, you know, might be exporting to Hong Kong or Singapore or other countries which are non-phyto. China's phytosanitary, so there's a specific protocol that's got to be met with some forms of treatment, and that might vary depending on the region and the particular commodity. So it's a complex component to get right for growers, and the more that the growers go into the market, they learn a bit more about you know, the taste buds, demographics, what is required to satisfy that particular market.
And in terms of the different varieties of summer fruits, which ones were you surprised with some of the standouts?
I think certainly the plum sector and the nectarine sector are probably two that are really where the growth has been and will continue to be. And there's a lot of new varieties that are available around the world. And, you know, again, the challenge for growers is selecting the right varieties and oftentimes those varieties for specific markets based on people's taste buds.
And what opportunities do you foresee for the growers then?
There's some great opportunities to further expand the Chinese market. The 23,000 tonne in a market that's, 160 million tonne, it's a large market, so we're only a small percentage of that at this point in time.
Getting the fruit to market, to China, have there been any teething problems there in making sure the quality is up to standard?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, there are two basic ways: air freight, and obviously that's quick, but you know, the fruit needs to be treated potentially with methyl bromide in that form as a quick treatment. The sea freight is a cold storage situation, so it's in transit cold storage. The problem can be that you know, if the data loggers, so you get a spike in temperatures, that can have an effect. And then the other problem I think we're finding is, while it should be a relatively short trip, it's being exacerbated by the ships stopping off at different ports along the way. So somehow the industry, not only in summer fruit but across all horticulture, needs to look at how it can better get the shipping companies to minimise that time frame to get into those sorts of markets.
You travel around the country a lot. You talk to a lot of growers. In terms of water and labour, how much of an issue is that being raised with you at the moment?
It's a very major issue, certainly water and availability of water and the sharing of water for permanent crops, which is what we're talking here in tree crops, in other forms of agricultural horticulture that are quick turnaround crops, then it can be managed. But when you've got established trees that need to be kept up, then that is a real issue. And obviously most of the regions sit in the Murray-Darling Basin, and that's an area of great debate at the present moment as to whether that plan is working or not.
Last year was a really good year for summer fruits. So this coming year, do you see the water issues is really going to put a dent in perhaps what could be a very bright ending to next year?
Probably not just at the moment. I think water allocations for growers in most regions is reasonably strong. I suppose the real challenge is getting that additional rain to, rain-fed crop is so much better than having to rely purely on irrigation. But the challenges will come in the following years if we don't get good water, either locally wise or coming down from Queensland into the system.
That's Trevor Ranford, the CEO of Summer Fruit Australia, speaking there to Cherie von Hirschner. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 21 past 12. We're going to talk water in a moment with some record prices there and talk about sort of what's behind all of that. If water isn't your thing, coming up on The Country Hour, if you're still wondering what I was talking about with all the turkey jokes earlier, after the news and weather, we're going to talk turkey, and it has something to do with this.
Our turkeys in the Wimmera there, or rare turkeys, have got these red blood cells that are doing a great service to the community.
Why turkeys could be helping to save your life. That's coming up in The Country Hour. Stay tuned for that. But let's talk water now. Panic buying or the new normal? Water prices have just pushed past $700 a megalitre in the Murray. And Lex Batters, the CEO of water trading firm H2OX, says the immediate jump in price was due to changes in laws made by the Victorian government last week. We spoke about that and what's happening to water markets at the moment.
Yeah, sure. Look, there's a lot going on in water at the moment. We've got a lot of reviews going on. But the main thing that's happened in the last week is Lisa Neville has come out in Victoria and basically announced that tagged ABAs from the Goulburn into the Murray are going to be suspended come December.
Closing a loophole there, isn't she?
She's closing a trading loophole that's let certain irrigators in the Murray access water in the Goulburn when that trading restriction has been in place. So traditionally there's a trading restriction in place between the Goulburn and the Murray. When that's shut, it means that water shouldn't be able to leave the Goulburn. But these tagged ABAs let certain irrigators buy Goulburn water to use in the Murray whilst that trading restriction is in place.
So it effectively allowed them to get around that loophole and get the water down the Goulburn and into the Murray.
That's right. So they could use Goulburn water on their farms in the Murray. They couldn't on-sell that Goulburn water. But what they could do is substitute their Murray entitlements with lower-priced Goulburn water and sell on that that Zone 7 water if they chose to.
So what has the market done once it was announced that loophole is being closed?
Look, the market's responded quite strongly, I guess, as you'd expect. So we've seen prices in the Murray rise. So they've gone from about $630 to $700 over the last week. The bigger move's probably been in the Goulburn, where we've seen prices go from, as low as $490 a megalitre about 10 days ago up to $580, $590 today. And really, it's an undersupplied market. So that market's probably going to continue to rise in the short term because we're struggling to find sellers at those prices in the Goulburn and in the Murray.
So with water now priced between $600 and $700, really, in the Goulburn and Murray, that's extraordinarily high prices. We're talking sort of not since the panic buying period of the last drought, aren't we, for prices of water that
high? That's right. Yeah, prices haven't been this high since that sort of 2007, 2008 period where we're at the height of the last drought and water supplies were probably in a worse state than they are now. But the world's changed a bit since then, obviously, in terms of water efficiency across the board and how much people are using and how much they can afford to pay for that water, but also, obviously, the explosion in permanent plantings we've seen in that period. So you've got a whole lot of irrigators out there now who have got tree crops that they kind of let afford to let go, And as such, they're having to pay the prices that we're seeing at the moment. And a lot of the buying we're seeing at the moment also is people who are, I guess, who have those permanent plantings who are concerned not only about this year with it remaining dry, but what happens if it remains dry into next year.
Is the water price going to continue going up in its current state?
Look, I think it could. The reason for that is obviously the forecast is pretty grim. We've got a positive Indian Ocean dipole that's still in play. Inflows have been not horrendous, but have been bad. And I guess there's just a lot of fear in the market that it is going to remain dry and those permanent plantings are going to struggle to secure the water they need. You know, on the flip side of that, if we do see any improvement in the outlook, that price could come back quite quickly, particularly if the long-term outlook improves and we start to see a bit more rain. One of the issues we have in the water market is you have a quite inefficient market. Which you know is pushing prices up where perhaps they should be if models are suggesting those prices under the extreme dry at $590, which is you know obviously $100 below where we are in the Goulburn and in the Murray, and is the current Goulburn price, and we're not in an extreme dry scenario just yet. So there is a lot of fear and other sort of uncertainty in the market that's pushing those prices higher. That's pretty difficult to model.
Well, and I suppose that was the story of that first major spike in water markets in the 2007 sort of 8 period during the drought when prices spiked over $1,000 for a megalitre of water. It was a lot of it was put down to panic buying of people who hadn't been through situations like this before. Are we going through another cycle of panic buying now?
I'm not sure we're in panic buying levels just yet. You know, 2007-8, when we saw those prices over $1,000, we had SA allocations on 18%. Basically, irrigators were told they weren't going to get any more, which resulted in that sort of panic buy and that quick spike where prices went up over $1,000 before SA found a bit more water and the price came back down within a week or two. So we haven't that sort of mass panic buying where someone enters the market and just buys everything they can get their hands on. People are acting in a more sophisticated way than that, but there are a lot of people out there that are concerned about where water prices might go over the next 12 months, and particularly from the permanent planting groups where at these prices, whilst these prices are very unpleasant for them, they are still affordable. Whereas if we enter into if this drought continues for another 12 months, prices may not be affordable anymore. So they'd rather buy now, have that water aside, know they can make money over the next 12 months, rather than sitting back and hoping it's going to rain.
At what point does water get too expensive for things like almonds or citrus or table grapes, those permanent plantings that have been able to pay more historically?
Look, it's really difficult to put a price on that. Obviously, everyone's got a different price point. You've probably got some of the older almond trees out there now that are approaching a point where it is no longer, I guess, affordable for them to continue on that, irrigating that crop. But the other thing you've got to take into account for almond trees is it's not a single year crop. So if they do reduce water this year as a result of high prices, that's going to impact next year's crop and potentially the crop of the year after that. So they will push through that price where they are no longer making money in the short term because they don't want to impact their crops going forward. But you'll probably get to a point where we may see a transition as well, and some of those almond growers that have older almond trees might start replacing those trees that are approaching the end of their lives this year, which might take their water use from 15 megs to, say, 3 megs, as a way of cutting those costs and reducing the amount of water they have to put on rather than reducing the amount of water they're putting on their high-yielding crops.
Lex Batters, thanks for joining us on the Country Hour.
Pleasure. Thanks, Warwick.
That's Lex Batters, CEO of water trading firm H2OX. So that's really the short-term look at where the water market sits. Let's talk the long-term trends now, because water consultancy firm Aether has released a report saying the cost of irrigation water in the southern Murray-Darling Basin has skyrocketed by nearly 140% in just 12 months. Director of Aether, Chris Olzak, says the price change is part of a new normal for prices set by an explosion of thirsty permanent planting crops in the Lower Murray that can afford to pay more for water.
Yeah, thanks, Warwick. So this report is a really factual market transparency report on what happened in the allocation market and the entitlement market over 2018-19. And it provides our outlook into 2019-20. So it brings together information from across the three states in the Southern Connected System to analyse how the market has changed over the course of the year.
And you found it's more expensive.
Absolutely. I think last year at this time, we noted that, you know, there was a dry land drought and it had the real potential to turn into an irrigation drought and for that to increase prices. But we were surprised at just how extensive and how significant the upward price movement was in both the allocation market and in the entitlement market as well. And there's a whole lot of factors that were driving that on the supply side and on the demand side. But yeah, we had prices increase through the year, starting from about $230 per megalitre at the start of the year and increasing to above $550 per megalitre as a monthly average in June. And we also had a couple of spikes in the year, say in the Murrumbidgee in January, where the price reached up to $700 per megalitre. And that was off the back of cotton growers getting a bit caught short and having to jump back into the market. In terms of water entitlements, they went up by 24% over the 12 months compared to the year before. So all of the entitlements in the Southern Connected System are currently worth $22.7 billion. And that's up from $6.8 billion when we first did our report 6 years ago.
As far as looking ahead towards next season, what's the report telling you?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the allocation market, what we're suggesting in terms of our outlook is that, you know, the system's still on a bit of a knife's edge here, and we really need further inflows and allocations to really take any heat out of the allocation market. What we've seen is that it's still rising in many areas, and particularly in the Lower Murray. We think this year is going to be a story of the trade constraints, with the Goulburn closed, the Choke has been closed, and the Murrumbidgee is now closed to the Murray. We think the area of most pressure is going to be that Lower Murray horticultural area, where the allocation price could go up further and is likely to be higher than the other zones.
That's Chris Olzak, director at Aether. We had a much longer chat to him not long ago on the Country Hour. And if you go to our website, abc.net.au/rural, and you go to the program section, you'll see our podcast is there, but there's also a segments section. You can go in there and find a long chat with Chris Olzak about what's happening to water markets and how they're changing. It's well worth a listen if water is your thing. It is 28 to 1, though, on the Country Hour, and I've been, well, making our news journalist, Matt Neal, wait well beyond time to bring us regional news headlines. Let's go there now and find out what's making news. G'day, Matt.
Good afternoon, Warwick. The Dean of the Australian Catholic University in Ballarat says publicity around the campus's association with George Pell has had no impact on its open day. More than 1,000 prospective students have attended an open day at the campus, which has a building named after the Cardinal. Police were called to reports of a large gum tree that was on fire near the Western Highway at Dobie just before 4 o'clock this morning. It occurred about 1 kilometre east of the group of protesters camping along the highway and is believed to be deliberately lit. Police say it's too early to know if the tree fire is linked to the ongoing protests to the highway duplication, but say it could have been lit by someone opposed to the protesting group. The highway is open in both directions, but an overtaking lane is closed, heading in an easterly direction near where the incident occurred. The table grape industry has become the first fresh fruit industry to export more than $500 million worth of product. The Australian Table Grape Association says it expects more than $600 million Australian dollars worth of grapes will be exported by the season's end. Mount Hotham will extend its 2019 ski season until the first weekend of October after weeks of favourable snowfall. The Victorian Alps resorts are having a bumper season with over 3 metres of snowfall at Hotham already this season and a natural snow base of 142 centimetres. And Glenelg Shire Council has received 5 objections to Victoria Police's retrospective application to relocate the historic Dartmoor Police Station. The heritage-listed building was moved 100 kilometres southeast to Port Ferry in June, despite a council order demanding works be stopped due to a lack of appropriate permits. Councillors will vote tomorrow night on whether to grant Victoria Police's after-the-fact planning permit. And you can find more news at abc.net.au/news.
Hey, Matt. Congratulations on the award.
Thank you, Warwick.
Thank you. That's award-winning journalist Matt Neal, who won Best Online News Story in the Rural Press Club of Victoria Awards on the weekend. The ABC actually won a few others. Clint Jasper's great work on Landline for the Barmer Choke as well was among those winners on the night. So congratulations to all the winners and well done to the ABC. Thought I'd give that a mention since we have an award-winning journalist reading your news headlines for you today. I'm sure there's a big future for another Matt on our program now. Matt Michael, who was with us last week from the Bureau of Meteorology to tell us what's happening weather-wise, and he can join us again now to tell us what weather-wise around Victoria for this week. G'day, Matt.
G'day, Warwick and listeners.
Well, what are we looking at the moment? A sunnier day today?
Well, yes, a few sunny breaks hopefully this afternoon. It is partly cloudy pretty much right across Victoria at the moment. And we're within a few degrees of the maximum already, so people probably won't feel noticeably warmer over the course of the afternoon. But I think, personally, it looks like a pretty pleasant day outside right now.
Exactly. I think it does too when I'm sitting here in my ivory tower in the studio looking at a sunny day in Shepparton. I can tell you that. What do we expect from here? What are the next few days got ahead for us?
Well, tomorrow is pretty much a cut and paste of today. So we're still under the influence of the high pressure system that's sitting over the Bight that'll slowly be making its way towards us over the next few days. So that ridge will keep conditions fairly clear across particularly inland Victoria tomorrow morning. So we are expecting temperatures to get right down to around 0 degrees for a lot of locations. So we'll see a light frost for northwestern Victoria and a normal frost for most of the rest of the north and east of the state. We are expecting some cloudier conditions over the southwest and for the central district, so it's unlikely we'll get as low as a frost there, particularly along the coast, and we will see some isolated shower activity on and off, mostly Tuesday morning, but maybe a light shower in the afternoon for the southwest and central parts. So, yeah, well, actually, pretty much exactly the same as today. Afternoon temperatures will be around 15 or 16 degrees, which is exactly what we're going to have this afternoon. So not very different. But Wednesday we have a more significant feature coming. So we've got a big low-pressure system and a cold front that's developing over waters to our south. So that will push across us through the day on Wednesday. So we'll see shower activity extending from the southwest of the state, reaching central districts in the afternoon and extending across eastern Victoria in the evening. And with that, we'll see around 5 to 10 millimetres of rainfall across the southwest and also for the eastern ranges, and generally rainfall around 2 to 5 millimetres elsewhere, and maybe some isolated higher totals up to around 15 or possibly even 20 millimetres. And with that, we'll see a moderate to fresh northwesterly wind shifting southwesterly and then southerly following the change. And as it does that, we'll see much colder temperatures moving in and snow levels dropping to around 700 metres. So that'll be by Wednesday afternoon. So we could see another little dump of snow for the Alpine resorts, maybe as much as 10 to 15 centimetres falling by the end of the day on Wednesday. Temperatures on Wednesday morning will be low single digits for a lot of central Victoria, and southern Victoria will be higher single figures, around 7 or 8 degrees. And the afternoon temperatures for most of Victoria, they'll probably be in the mid-teens, around 13 to 15 degrees. But with the persistent northwesterly flow and the delay of the cold front, the temperatures across Gippsland will actually be quite mild, around 16 or 18 degrees across Gippsland on Wednesday. Thursday, we see the focus of the shower activity shifting to East Gippsland, so hopefully we'll see some welcome rainfall there. At this stage, with showers throughout the day in Gippsland, we will have on the forecast around 5 to 10 millimetres falling by the end of Thursday. A little bit of shower activity elsewhere for southern and eastern Victoria, and it'll all contract eastwards through the day and ease. And temperatures will be quite cold, low single figures in the morning following that cold air in the southerly flow, and in the mid-teens for the afternoon. And ending the working week, it'll be fairly clear and cold on Friday morning as a high pressure system moves over us following the passage of that front. we'll see a continuing south or southeasterly flow and probably a little bit of light shower activity continuing for East Gippsland. Temperatures in the morning will be pretty close to 0 or 1 degree, so we can expect a return to frosty conditions over much of western and northern Victoria in particular. And clear, probably sunny conditions across most of the state in the afternoon, with temperatures nudging the mid to high teens. And we'll see, well, hopefully at this stage, if everything bears out for the passage of the next high pressure system, we'll see Saturday and Sunday a little bit of shower activity for southern Victoria, but temperatures in the mid to high teens right across the state. So we could crack 20 degrees for a few locations by Sunday to end winter.
Oh, there we go. I suppose I should sound more excited. I just want more rain on the forecast for those areas that are dry, Matt. But anyway, you're right. You're right. For 20, a lot of people will be very happy if they can enter spring with a T-shirt on or something like that.
Well,
so I should be happy.
Fingers crossed we have better news for the rainfall. There is still plenty of uncertainty for Thursday and Friday. So some of the models do have more rainfall for East Gippsland than I've mentioned. But at this stage, the confidence of that is pretty low.
We'll keep an eye on it. Matt, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks, Warwick.
Matt Michael at the Bureau of Meteorology taking us through, well, the next few days in the weather forecast. On the text on 0467 842 722, we're speaking about penalty rates in horticulture before and why, how growers are starting to automate a lot more so they don't have to pay them. Cole says, penalty rates make work attractive. Take away the rate, take away the penalty rate, take away the attractiveness. And he was saying he'll gladly pay more. Make sure workers are happy. Thanks very much for your text, Cole. Alan in Shepparton, talking about water prices, says we are certainly doomed as irrigation goes, and our elected politicians are letting us go down the gurgler. On the text as well there from Alan on 0467 842 722. And I made a lot of turkey jokes earlier. We're about to go to a turkey story here on the Country Hour. I won't subject you to those jokes again, because that would be cruel punishment. But one person just simply says, Warwick Long, you're the punniest guy in radio. Thank you, I think. And another person says, do the turkeys have to have feathers? There's a featherless variety in Canberra. Oh, now behave. Be nice. Let's go to turkeys now. It's 19 to 1 on the Country Hour. Let's meet the turkeys, in fact, that are behind your flu vax. Yes. Rare turkeys in Western Victoria are doing their bit to protect the human race from the influenza virus. Their blood is used to preempt which viruses should be included in the annual flu vaccine. And as Danny Grinlay reports, it's a feather in the cap of a farmer who has received little financial reward for 60 years of rare turkey breeding.
Deutsch's Turkey Farm, Daryl speaking.
Daryl Deutscher isn't the greatest businessman. There's a huge demand for his product, but he's blinded by a fascination with rare turkeys.
It becomes a bit of an obsession for people who are passionate about turkeys and love their turkeys. It becomes an obsession.
The 69-year-old has been breeding rare varieties since he was a young boy and now has 6,000 birds at this free-range farm in Dadswells Bridge, Western Victoria.
And these are what I call the fatal ones. They look like somebody threw a can of paint at their wings when you spread their wing feathers out, and they all have blue eyes.
They're even more intriguing to look at than your standard turkey, with a huge array of colours and markings. But they cost a lot to create. They take longer to grow and don't produce as much meat as commercial birds. And yet, they sell for exactly the same price.
Yeah, unfortunately, in my case, probably passion takes over from the good business a lot of the time. Some of my contemporaries in the business, who are probably making heaps of money out of doing commercial birds, and they sort of shake their heads or raise their eyebrows. I guess we're all sticking our own ways up here.
Okay, do you want to look at some little baby turkeys?
While there's no market for rare turkey meat as yet, Daryl attracts some unique customers. The rare turkey feathers are highly sought after by arrow makers, fly fishers and craftsmen.
By the time you bugger your shoulders up and everything like that, pulling all the feathers out and then time to grade them and everything like that, it gives you a few $1,000 extra a year and makes you kid yourself it's worthwhile or something like that, I guess.
And then there are the scientists, using Daryl's turkeys in a global fight against influenza.
It's a bit of an arms race.
we need to get a global perspective on what's happening with influenza at certain points in time.
This is Professor Ian Barr, who heads up the World Health Organization's Collaborating Centre for Reference and Research on Influenza.
We're trying to keep up with the changes in the virus so that the vaccine best matches the circulating viruses.
Professor Barr's job is to figure out which viruses are going to hit humans hardest in the coming season. Those viruses are then combined into a vaccine, the flu shot, for all countries in the Southern Hemisphere. It requires monitoring a list of viruses, which continuously morph and evolve. He does that using Daryl Deutsch's Dadswell's Bridge turkeys.
Turkey red blood cells have a nucleated red cells, which is quite unusual. We don't have those in mammalian cells. And what that does is it makes those red cells settle much quicker in the assay, and they're much easier to read.
At the end of next month, the WHO and its international counterparts will meet in Geneva, Switzerland, to finalise that list of viruses for the 2020 vaccine. It's a vital decision that Professor Barr, in part, credits to Daryl Deutsch's turkeys.
They're an essential part because we understand the properties of those red blood cells very well, and we can get continuous amounts from turkeys. So, yes, I'd say they're a vital part of our day-to-day activities.
Once the turkeys have finished providing blood to the cause, they're rehomed as pets. An important detail for Daryl.
Yeah, that's fantastic, because sometimes I have some special birds, and they say it's not a charity farm, so I can't keep heaps of birds past their use-by date when they're no longer productive. So sometimes, knowing that they're not going to be slaughtered and I can pass them off to somebody else, it makes me feel better about things as well.
It also shines a new light on his prized birds.
There's an old saying about new turkey if somebody's been stupid or something like that, or is an idiot. So, maybe people will say, oh, well, our turkeys in the Wimmera are there, or rare turkeys have got these red blood cells that are doing a great service to the community.
Yeah, Daryl, hopefully you turkey means you're a lifesaver, like those turkeys helping your flu vaccine. That was Daryl Deutscher at his farm at Dadswell's Bridge, ending that story from Danny Grinlay. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 14-1. We'll go away from turkeys now and talk about some annoying little plants that are getting more and more resistant to herbicide. Herbicide resistance is one of the biggest challenges farmers face in an era when reliance on chemicals is greater than ever. But by using chemicals with different modes of action rather than the same old products, farmers are, for the most part, managing to keep resistance in check. That's according to resistance expert Peter Boutsalis, who visited the Wimmera last week. He says ryegrass is the biggest problem, but other weeds are also proving to be problematic.
In this area, we've got things like milk thistle, or some people call it sow thistle, resistant to the group B herbicides. We've got Indian hedge mustard, resistant to many of the herbicides that are currently active. Also brome, we've got about 10% resistance detected to things like Verdict, but that hasn't increased over the last 10 years. So resistance in these other grasses like brome and barley grass and wild oats has stayed at about the 10% mark without increasing any further.
On the point of new chemicals, is that chemical development keeping pace with resistance?
Yeah, some people say that it's dried up and there's no new herbicides coming into the market, and that is completely false. Many companies have put a lot of investment, and to date there are numerous new modes of action available, some coming next year for use in broadacre farming and some coming in the coming years. So there's never been a situation in the history of herbicides that we've had so many different modes of action available to control multiple resistant ryegrass and also some of the other key weed species.
How about on the subject of rates? You talked about making sure you use a high enough rate that you kill the weed and you don't just make it resistant. But continually using higher and higher rates, is that more of a short-term fix than a long-term solution?
The only reason we are using higher and higher rates is because weeds are being left behind that have survived a herbicide. And to species like ryegrass or wild radish, which must cross-pollinate to produce viable seed, those weaker mechanisms are crossing, and so the next generations are more resistant. If we could stop those, then resistance wouldn't increase. But because they're creeping through the system, we're using high and high rates. So the thing is to leave no survivors, because often those survivors are those very few ones that have those rare, strong resistance mechanisms. And if they're not controlled, resistance increases and you need high rates. If they are controlled, resistance does increase.
Last time you surveyed for resistance in the Wimmera was in 2015. You're coming back next year to do another survey. Do you expect to find increased resistance?
I actually don't think we'll find too much increase in resistance to the Group A's and the Group B's, and probably trifluralin resistance is unlikely to have increased. But we may start to see a little bit more resistance to some of the newer pre-emergent herbicides, such as the Group J and K herbicides, and perhaps maybe a little bit more resistance to glyphosate. Also, some of the other weed species, we may start to see some other resistances creeping in some of the broadleaf weeds as well.
What can farmers do to determine whether they actually do have resistance before it becomes a major problem, I suppose?
The easiest thing is to conduct a resistance test. There are two tests available. There is a seed test, which growers send me seeds prior to harvest or just after harvest, or the quick test, which they can send me plants growing in the field. So after a spray job, if there are survivors or plants that have survived, you want to see if they are resistant or not, then we can actually test those for resistance and have an answer within 4 weeks.
That's herbicide resistance expert Peter Batsalis from the University of Adelaide. This is The Country Hour, and to finish our program today, we might as well have a nice drop of red, shall we? Have you ever had a drop of the red, though, called Zweigelt? It's an Austrian wine, a big hit in Northern Europe, and in Northwest Victorian Winery in Australia is now hoping to release their latest effort at bottling the grape and hoping it'll be popular down under. Sheree von Hirschner caught up with winemakers David King and Frank Molo, who explain what it's like to work with a new variety like this from scratch.
We come about Zweigelt through Andrew Peace, who loved this variety. It's an Austrian variety. He really wanted to get it into Australia. After about 2.5 years in quarantine, we have a plantation 4 acres of Zweigelt today. So the first harvest off Zweigelt was 2015. Back then it was only 25 vines, and we harvested approximately 350 kilograms of fruit, therefore making 150 bottles just as an experiment, just to see what the variety was like. Last vintage, we harvested 40 tons, and we have just bottled our first commercial Zweigelt, 2018.
David King, you're the senior winemaker here at Andrew Peace Wines. What goes into, what kinds of things do you need to consider when you're working together and to bring the best out or the most out of such a wine?
Well, really, it's not really known to grow well in this climate. So being an Austrian variety, it tends to be a lot cooler. Firstly, we tried as many Zweigelts as we could. We have a friend in Austria who sent us a few bottles. And then, I guess, make the best wine we can from the year, and try to display the best of the variety in the bottle.
So this particular variety, the Zweigelt, what does it taste like?
For me, it displays a lot of cherry characters, some spice, quite perfumed on the nose. And then and on the palate, there's some peppery characters. It's medium-bodied. I wouldn't say it's full-bodied. So it's, well, we think it'll go really well with food. Most European wines do, and that was the way we intended when we bottled it.
You were saying earlier that this particular variety is typically grown in cooler climates. Was there anything that came up during the winemaking process that reflected that, and perhaps this not being quite, you know, an unusual climate to be trying to grow it?
Well, I guess the heat knocked it around, especially this year. We weren't getting the big canopies we're used to with other varieties. So picking times were very critical. I think the 2018, which we've just bottled, the picking, we picked at the right time, and it's got some nice natural acidity, but like generous fruit flavours as well.
So, Frank, in your view, what kinds of things did you have to think about, or what was sort of a bit tricky with this particular variety?
Prior to this, I had no idea of what Zweigelt, how it's made or what it's meant to taste like. If it was meant to be a big wine, if it was meant to be an easy drinking wine. And yeah, we just wanted to make it different than your your Shiraz or your Cabernet or your Merlot.
In Austria, how popular is this particular variety, right?
Yeah, it's very popular. It's made in so many different ways, like it's made as a reserve, it's made as an aged wine. It's used a lot in blending, so they use it quite a lot.
And so, David, when you're collaborating together with the two of you just in this winemaking process, what kinds of things do you think about in doing such a thing?
Yeah, it's just constant tasting, doing such a small volume. It was barrel selection. Some barrels display new oak characters and then some are an older, show older flavours. We probably took a day worth of blending to come up with the winning combination, and you still don't know until it's bottled what the final blend will taste like.
In terms of being a winemaker, having this opportunity to sort of have a go with a variety you don't really have any experience with, how often do you get this opportunity?
Very rarely, especially a variety that we've brought in from overseas and we've propagated ourselves. And I've been here for 10 years and there's been talk of Zweigelt for that long. And to finally see a bottled wine is actually quite, it's years of hard work paid off really for everyone.
That's winemakers David King and Frank Molo at Andrew Peace Winery in Piangil talking Zweigelt there. Market time, let's get into it. Here's Brendan Fletcher at Pakenham.
G'day Warwick, numbers decreased to 340, that's 430 fewer, with the usual buyers operating in a dearer market. Quality was limited with prime cattle in short supply and wintry lots throughout. Trade cattle gained 10 cents, grown steers and bullocks improved 5 to 10, manufacturing steers held firm. Cows lifted 5 to 15 cents and more in places, with processors loading cows for an estimated 4.99 to 5.65 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls gained 10 cents. Yearling steers sold from 2.95 to 3.40, heifers to the trade 2.96 to 3.29. Grown steers 3.33 to 3.55, bullocks 3.35 to 3.59. Heavy Friesian steers 2.55 to 2.80, crossbreds 2.90 to 3.16. Most light and medium weight cows 170 to 266, heavyweights 238 to 310, heavy bulls 281 to 339. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's go to Wagga Cattle now and Leanne Dax.
There was an increase in the number of cattle offered this week at Mortlake, an increase of 122 to 335. There was a mixed offering in the trade cattle offered this week and an increase in the number of cows offered. Not all the processors were present or active at today's sale. There was more activity from restockers and feeders. The market was generally unchanged for trade cattle. However, the cow section was softer, being 10 cents a kilogram cheaper. Yearling steers to the trade sold to 2.98 cents, with heifers to the trade selling between 2.60 and 320 cents. Feeders were active, paying up to 295 cents. C3 and C4 grown steers and bullocks made from 262 to a top of 336 cents for an outstanding pen of B-muscle steers. Grown heifers made from 280 to 306 cents. Manufacturing bullocks made from 246 to a top of 284. 3 and 4 score beef cows sold between 262 to 283. Light cows sold between 130 and 240 cents. The better bulls sold between 257 and 287 cents. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
That was Leanne Dax, sounded very much like Chris Agnew, and Wagga Wagga sounded very much like Mortlake there. That was obviously the Mortlake Cattle Market Report. Let's go to the Wagga Cattle Market Report now. Here's Leanne Dax.
Numbers increased marginally to 3,600. The market continued to struggle again this week, with numbers outpacing demand from feedlots and restockers, resulting in feeder steer prices dipping 9 to 15 cents, 260 to 323. Restocking weaner steers slipped 5 cents, 239 to 314. Feeder heifers were firm to 5 easier, 240 to 306. The one positive trend was well-finished trade and heavy export cattle sold to strong demand. Trade steers gained 5, $3 to 360. Trade heifers improved 12, 290 to 348. Grown steers lifted 3 cents, 296. To 359, bullocks 272 to 350, heavy cows are up 10 cents, 260 to 296, and the middle run sold from 220 to 276. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Lucky last is Jenny Kelly at Bendigo.
Overall lamb numbers remain similar at 12,000 head, with about 4,000 of these being suckers.
The pick of the heavy suckers were firm, while others eased $5 to $10, with the 26 to 28 kilo pens from $214 to a top of $231. The nice trade weight suckers, $180 to $210. Carcass estimates for fresh suckers, $7.80 to $8.20 a kilo. Lightweight suckers, $146 to $168 to processors. Little to suit restockers today. Old lamb quality is now very mixed and prices are bouncing around based on condition and skin presentation. Very long wool lambs are being discounted. Interest in real heavy old lambs, 30 kilos plus, was dull, and these were $15 cheaper at $225 to $235. The good heavy trades, $180 to $220 to be dearer in places, and secondary old lambs over 20 kilos, $140 to $170. On a carcass basis, there is now a big spread over old lambs, going from below $7 to just over $8 for the neat shorn trade weights.
Sorry, Jenny, got to go. We'll run out of time. That's it for the Country Hour today. Sorry, we couldn't quite get everything in for you. We'll catch you again at the same time tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.